Good morning, and welcome to the July 27th, 2010 WikiVolunteer Insight Research Meeting, where peers discuss challenging problems in the data center. I'm your host and moderator, Dave Vellante, and the topic for today is Data Center Networks Beyond Spanning Tree. And Wikibon is very pleased to welcome our guest today, Brad Hedlund, who is a technology solution architect at Cisco in the Chicago area. Welcome, Brad.
Thanks, guys, and it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So folks should know that in Brad's limited spare time, he authors a blog, which is can be found at Brad Hedlund. It's Brad, H-E-D-L-U-N-D.com. The theme is Studies in Data Center Networking, Virtualization, and Computing. So that's a good resource. And also here at the Wikibon offices in Marlboro is Stu Miniman, our newest contributor to the Wikibon community. Welcome, Stu.
Thanks, Dave.
So some quick housekeeping, if I can. I'd like to ask that if you're not speaking on the call, if you could mute your line, and if your phone doesn't have a mute button, you can hit *6 to mute, and then *6 to unmute if you want to participate, which, of course, everybody is welcome to do and encouraged to do. This call is being recorded. It'll last 1 hour. If you want to tweet this call, please use the #Wikibon hash so it will auto-feed into social media outlets. So let me shut the call up. If you look at current network topologies, they appear inadequate to meet the scalability and flexibility requirements of the virtualized data center, which is, as we all know, burgeoning. New network architectures are coming out that transform that data center by removing the constraints enabling application mobility. And we're going to talk a little bit about that today. And virtualization is the underpinning of this trend as an enabling technology. So IT shops have to become more efficient if they're going to compete with the economics of outsourcing to cloud service providers. So once again, Brad, thanks for coming on the call today. Why don't we start with you? Tell us a little bit about your role at Cisco and some of the challenges that you see customers facing.
Yeah, well, thanks, Dave. My role at Cisco primarily is I'm here in the central part of the United States in the Chicago area, so I'm a data center architect here for the Cisco sales team in the central U.S. So my primary responsibility is to meet with customers and help them figure out some of these challenges and put together a strategy for how their data center is going to evolve, you know, be it 1 year, 2 years, 3 years from now. So a lot of what we're talking about, just as you pointed out, is how are they going to adopt to this trend of virtualization? I mean, things have changed a lot with data centers in the last 3 to 5 years where, you know, you'd say 5 years ago, workloads were very static in the sense that they ran on a server you could point at. It had a label on it. It had a specific rack or a row that application ran from. And the network team could basically build very structured networks around that, you know, things like layer 3 switching and whatnot. But, you know, with virtualization, that has squarely turned upside down in the sense that now the trend is to abstract the workload from a physical location in the data center so that it can be moved and reappropriated to a resource that may cost less money or may have underutilization. Maybe we need to increase utilization in other parts of the data center, or perhaps even in the future send that workload out to a cloud service provider at any given point. So those are some of the things that I'm helping customers with, basically evangelizing Cisco technologies in that market. But on the side, in my spare time, whatever spare time I do have, I like to write up some of those things on my blog and participate in some of the social media conversations on Twitter, et cetera.
Excellent. So, Stu, maybe you could take us at a high level, and then we can drill down a little bit. What is the spanning tree protocol, and how is it? Is it a limiting factor in network architectures?
Okay, basically, Dave, what spanning tree protocol does is between any two devices, you can only have a single link active at any time. The reason that was done was really for security purposes to make sure that we don't set up a loop in Ethernet terms, which would be very bad. But the challenge is that really, if you talk about the utility of your switches and the utility of the bandwidth that you have available, it is rather limiting. And as Brad talked about, the changes that we're seeing in the network, not only with virtualization, but as we start going to 10 gigabit and 40 gigabit and 100 gigabit bandwidth, the cost at a per port level and for all of the components is going to be a lot more. So while not having a 1 gig port active wasn't that expensive, when you start talking about 10 gig ports and denser configurations, the per port cost is a lot more, and you want to utilize that. So there have been a lot of options over the last few years as to how we can either enhance or replace spanning tree protocol, and some of those it require some significant re-architecture of network architectures.
So Brad, I just wonder if you could draw on your experience with customers or anybody else up there on the call. Is this a sort of a widespread problem? Is this something that you guys are going to hit in the next, 5 to 10 years, or what is read to which customer facing really helpful?
Yeah, so I think Stu touched on that, and the transition to 10 gig, both at the server level and both at the server access layer in the data center, when those uplinks out of the server access layer switch become 10 gig instead of 1 gig, a lot of expensive bandwidth to be blocked by a spanning tree link. So, we're looking at that's what customers are really looking at today in terms of how do I enable more bandwidth from 10 gig architectures that are being rolled in today, and then looking out towards the future, how does that scale beyond just spanning tree? And I think that's where there's evolutionary technologies such as Trill, et cetera, to handle that moving out into the next several years. But I think really as it is today, servers are starting to be equipped with 10 gig. Even some are showing up on the dock with 10 gig. And with server virtualization, a lot more virtual machines are running on a given physical server. So IO to that server becomes important. So we're seeing a lot more 10 gig attached servers. We're seeing a lot more dense 10 gig switching environments in the data center, even at the top of rack and the server access layer, all of that results in more and more 10 gig dense platforms in the core of the network as well. So I think really the first thing, as I've said before here, is, and as Stu touched on, really enabling more bandwidth, all of those links, to make sure you're utilizing them all, whereas a spanning tree is going to have the tendency to block those paths. So I think really that's what's sort of top of mind with customers right now. And also just enabling that workload mobility that the server and application teams are asking for, right? The ability to vMotion a virtual machine from one data center to the next or within data centers. How can the network architecture support that type of flexibility, but in a way that makes sense and with common sense design?
So Stu had mentioned before it's really a cost factor, efficiency, a utilization play. Can you just sort of roughly describe the cost per port for, say, the difference between 1 gig and 10 gig? What are we looking at here?
Well, that's changed a lot over the last few years. It started out very high. There was a very high price difference in a 10 gig port versus a 1 gig port on a switch, and it really also depended on if that was a layer 2 switch or a layer 3 switch. If you look at the modular platforms, I'll just, because I work for Cisco, I use Cisco example here, example 6500 or the Nexus 7000. Traditionally, those ports have been capable of all types of protocols and services, layer 2, layer 3, so they came at a very high cost. What we're seeing now is the evolution of the server access layer 10 gig environment, where a 10 gig port doesn't need to have all of the layer 3 capabilities that a port might need in the core of the network. So for example, a top of rack 10 gig switch can be a layer 2 only switch, and because of that, the cost of 10 gig networking at the server access layer has dramatically decreased over the last couple of years. In fact, we're looking at now around $250 per 10 gig port at the server access layer, which is where the economy of scale is. If you've got thousands of servers, hundreds of servers, if you're transitioning to 10 gig, that's where the sheer volume of ports is going to be, is at the server access layer. So that's where things have really changed. The cost of those ports is coming down. nonetheless, you know, looking at oversubscription rates too out of that server access layer, any links that would be blocking from Spanning Tree is really going to begin to punish those oversubscription rates, and that's something that customers are, at least ones I'm talking with, are concerned about too, is lowering oversubscription wherever possible.
And again, that comes down ultimately to a cost per port equation from a cost benefit standpoint, correct?
Well, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
And a 1 gig port is, you said 250 for a top of the rack, you know, 10 gig layer two. 1 gig is going to be what, $100 per port? I mean, just give us a rough estimate there.
Oh, let's see. Yeah, 1 gig switch, we're probably looking at $5,000 to $8,000 for a 1 gig top of rack switch, 48 ports. So if you, the actual price of the port, 1 gig versus 10 gig, 1 gig is still going to be lower. But if you look at the price of actual giggy of bandwidth, we're really starting to see a shift to where you can actually get more bandwidth for your dollar in 10 gig at the server access layer for these layer two 10 gig switches.
Yep.
Has really come down.
Brad, there's a general rule of thumb I've seen in some of the networking is that if you can get 10x of bandwidth for about 2.5x the price, that's usually when we see a tipping point and see customers just massively adopt that.
And I think we're getting close to that, at least from my perspective.
Yeah, and it's you're really seeing a lot of bottleneck changes in the system. So before, the server bus might have been the bottleneck. Now that you've got denser switches, we can really start to utilize more ports. And have to start looking, as you said, oversubscription. Older switches were heavily oversubscribed. A lot of the new switch architectures can run full bandwidth. So just a lot of different changes that customers have to think through as to the switch itself, how they're configuring it, the servers that go with it. It looks like it could be rather confusing.
Yeah, and then you have to ask yourself how are we architecting these networks any differently than we were in a 1 gig environment? And with denser platforms now in 10 gigs, so the you know, moving up from the server access layer now into the core and distribution, there's it used to be that to get 10 gig in there, you can maybe fit 4 ports on a line card, maybe 8, and you only had 8 slots to work with. That's changed now. You know, there's 10 and 18 slot switches with 32 port line cards, 10 gig line cards, a lot more density in these distribution switches, core switches, which allow for more of a flattening of the design, et cetera. And then we have to look at the top of rack switch. If I've got multiple links going to distribution switches, why should I have to punish any of that bandwidth with Spanning Tree, right? And that's how we're looking at technologies like multi-chassis ether channel, right? Analogous to Cisco would be virtual port channels in Nexus 7000 or VSS on a 6500. I'm seeing a lot of customers adopt those technologies right now.
So, Brad, I guess can you walk us through a little bit the evolution that you're seeing in the field of, you mentioned VSS and VPC, you know, how long have you been working on those technologies and how's the adoption rate picking up?
Yeah, I think it really starts back to even before VSS and VPC, where there was a need to get a more of a stable environment out of Spanning Tree. If we were going to build larger layer two networks, how can we get stability out of Spanning Tree? So Cisco started with Spanning Tree enhancements, right? And there was features that were brought into Spanning Tree to make it more stable, things like loop guard, things like root guard. Rapid Spanning Tree, per VLAN Spanning Tree, things like that. So we started out with Spanning Tree enhancements, and then since then it has evolved to things like multi-chassis ether channel, like VSS and the Catalyst 6500. That was out, I believe, back in 2007, the shipping there. And then there was that platform change from 6500 to Nexus platforms for 10 gig density, and VPC, virtual port channels, was sort of the analogous to VSS there to create that multi-chassis ether channel environment. If I've got a top-of-rack switch with a link to two separate core switches or aggregation, how can I make that look like one port channel, one logical link? So it really depended on what platform you had in the data center. If it was 6500, well, you were probably looking at doing VSS. See a lot of customers doing VSS with 6500s today. or if you had made that decision to go to a newer platform like the Nexus 7000, then VPC, Virtual Port Channels, that has been out for well over a year now. So seeing a lot of adoption of that technology with customers that have adopted that platform. And looking forward, so to the next step, there's of course the layer 2 multipathing solutions, where we actually bring a little bit more intelligence into how layer 2 frames are distributed across the various uplinks out of the top of rack switch and into the core of the network. If you've attended Cisco Live, there's the announcement of the Cisco Fabric Path, so that's the beginning of that. And then, as the standards begin to evolve, the analogous standard would be Trill, or 802.1Q, 802.1AQ, shortest path bridging. And so we'll see those standards evolve over the next couple of years. And that'll be another technology leap that customers can begin to, either adopt in greenfield data centers or, brownfield expansions, maybe VSS and VPC is fine for the size of their environment, and they may not need to go to the next step.
So, Brad, I wonder if you could take us back to, you mentioned a couple of options, mentioned VSS and VPC. Paint a picture of how a customer goes from point A to point B. What does he have to do? Is it new cards, new software? What kind of disruption does he have to absorb? Can you just share that with us?
Yeah, sure. So if I was in a classic spanning tree environment, and if I had, let's say, 6500s in there, and I wanted to convert that to a VSS environment where I can get the multi-chassis ether channel capabilities, typically, I have to take a look at what are the hardware upgrades I would need to do on that platform. To get VSS in your 6500, it's not just a software feature you turn on. There's a hardware requirement, and you have to have a specific supervisor engine. You have to have specific line cards in that platform. So, that might be some disruption there and getting that hardware installed and getting the outage windows to put that in. Once I've made that step, once I've got the hardware in place, then there's the actual conversion of that environment to VSS. So I need to take some steps to actually enable VSS on the 6500s, and that would be an outage that would be taken there, probably about a 5 to 10 minute outage if you're a rock star. And then now the top of rack switch environment, or all the server access layer switches, instead of seeing a spanning tree network upstream, that's going to change from just seeing a port channel. So where I had two links going to two switches, it's now going to look like one link with a single logical port channel going to one upstream switch. At least that's the logical topology. So I'd have to go to the top of rack or the end of row server access switches and change that from a spanning tree uplink to a port channel uplink, and that would be a change as well. So it's not like this can be done totally non-disruptive and totally transparent. It was something that you would have to plan for, think about, and really communicate to the application owners and the business that this is something that is needed to be done to progress the data center architecture, and we have to take the appropriate outages to do that.
So how do I, this brings up a good point. So I mean, if the primary ROI driver here is port utilization, which is a cost play, and I'd still like to better understand the cost, because my math is coming out to 10 gig and 1 gig are pretty close. But let's assume for a second there's a substantial enough difference. How do you convince the guys that in the organization don't really care about cost, like the application owners, for example, to actually move in this direction? I mean, what's in it for them?
Well, speaking from the network perspective, you could bring a cost angle to the business, but if that doesn't sink, you can also look at it from a bandwidth and capacity perspective. So, Mr. Application Owner, how would you like to have twice the available bandwidth available to your application when the network is healthy, right? And I think that's always going to translate into some interest. So there's the
application owners will never care about that.
Maybe
you directly care about that, but you have to communicate that to them in a way that appeals to the business. I mean, how does it translate in terms of numbers of transactions or amount of revenue I can get as a result of the extra capacity?
Is that Jerry?
Yes.
Hi, Jerry. Gary Murphy.
Of course, I'm always a springboard.
So Gary, you're bringing up an interesting point. Is what I think actually Brad was touching on is that maybe he just wasn't using the language of an application owner. So, I mean, essentially, you're talking about a better service level or quality of service, or maybe it's performance.
Networking guys need to think in those terms if they're not the ones paying for it, or if they need to convince somebody other than them, they need to talk in that person's language, not their own. That's my point.
I mean, I guess the question I have is this a big enough, chewy enough organizational challenge that practitioners who are interested and see real value in moving beyond sort of spanning tree, that they're going to have to really put their organizational ducks in line? Is it that big of a deal that they should actually go out and start, you know, thinking about how to do that, or is this sort of a slower multi-year migration?
Well, I think if if it's going to require any kind of significant, you know, production outage in order to make it happen, which it sounds like it will, then it has to have the buy-off of the business, and there needs to be a compelling business value to do it, not just because, you know, it's making a network manager's job easier. It's got to provide value in terms of, you know, the relative higher availability of the infrastructure to support the applications, how that translates in terms of loss of cost avoidance for downtime, increasing availability of bandwidth in terms of, you know, additional capacity this is going to bring in terms of revenue, and absolutely you're going to have to get the business buy-off if it's going to have any kind of, you know, core infrastructure outage that needs to be done for this.
Yeah, so it's going to play well for guys whose business is constricted by this existing architecture. But then again, the last thing you want to do is be in a position where you have a gun to your head and you have to make this change and force disruption. So that's the other piece that I'm still a little bit unclear on, Brad and Stu, is sort of what's that sweet spot for the customer? Where are we on the S-curve of adoption? I mean, this is really early phases, and can you take us through?
Well, and that's what I was poking at with Brad a little bit. If you look at this, I mean, it's really only been the last 3 years, and if you look at replacement cycles for customers, most of this is going to be disruptive if they want to do it. So it needs to be, you know, a shop that's implementing virtualization. They've got bottlenecks in their network that this will solve. And we're probably starting to get to, you know, some of these customers that want to refresh their environment and therefore, you know, would consider either building a new data center or doing a refresh of their environment. But, Brad probably a little closer to it.
So what I like the way you're going with this is you're giving some parameters for customers on the call. You're pursuing virtualization pretty aggressively, probably beyond test and dev, presumably.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And then you've got, you know, that's causing certain bottlenecks. You've probably got a degree of business growth. You know, you're probably getting pressure to outsource certain workloads or activities, and you're looking at cloud service providers saying, all right, do I go internal or external? I mean, are these some of the reasonable parameters that customers should be looking at? What do you think, Brad?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Virtualization is a big part of that. So you've got more server consolidation. You know, ultimately, IT has to begin to show a lower cost to the business in terms of providing those services because there's a new competitor out there that's never been there before, and especially the cloud service provider, right? So there's, you know, IT has to get more efficient and driving those costs down to deliver the application to the business, you know, as well as, you know, looking at the refresh cycles, as Stu pointed out too. What I'm seeing here in the field is, you know, a lot of new data centers, a lot of data center movements, a lot of new data centers. The life cycle of a data center typically is shorter than the equipment that is put into it, right? So there's just about every customer, you know, I'm talking to is either thinking about moving their data center or is in the process of doing so. So when you do that, that's a perfect time to look at, okay, how can I put in something from the beginning here that can, you know, set up to adopt these new architectures, you know, for whatever life cycle that data center is going to hold, et cetera. So
I would say that's a one-time small window of opportunity, though, frankly. I mean, what we're seeing in the last 3 or 4 years is where the power cooling issue is kind of knee past traditional growth rates. I think new data centers that are being built are not going to have a 3 or 4 year life cycle. I think we have an artifact of things that were built 7 years ago that crossed the knee on Moore's law for power densities, but now that people are seeing it's there, I think the new ones that are being built are scaling better, or people are going to, you know, coal facilities with massive oversubscription. So I think there's a window of opportunity there, but I don't think as a rule of thumb people can say from now on data centers are not going to live as long as the equipment. I completely disagree with that assumption.
Your point there, Jerry, being that a lot of data centers are running into the heat density limits because they were designed, you know, a long time ago.
They were built years ago, the last 20 years, and they've only lasted 10 years because nobody historically ever looked. I mean, power density of electricity and floor space, frankly, wasn't really much of a calculation in terms of, you know, power and cooling requirements for servers, but that's only really become an issue in the last 4 or 5 years when the power density of chips got to the point where, you know, they've sort of gotten a geometric progression in growth past, you know, classic facility power densities. But now that line has been crossed, people are redesigning with the new densities in place, and before another data center dies, we're going to at the point where you're probably going to have to bring water cooling into the data centers, which will lower the cooling power requirements by an order of magnitude when people are forced to do that in the next 7 to 10 years.
Well, I think it brings up another organizational point, too, which is CEOs in particular who funded a data center 10 years ago that didn't last the 20 years that they promised, they're probably forcing an organizational the organizational communications between the facilities folks and the IT people to do a better job planning.
Well that's another huge point, right? They're now talking and they realize that they have to integrally communicate where they used to be really completely separate organizations that never almost saw a need to talk to one another.
Yeah, I know David Foyer, I don't know if he's on the call, but he's done a lot of work in this area, and particularly you see it with the cloud service providers. That's the other question I had, Brad. Are you seeing, you know, acute demand, for example, within the cloud service provider space? Maybe that's an obvious question, but we found that these organizations do a much better job planning, communicating, you know, arbitraging technology very intelligently, and are probably even, you know, certainly more ahead of the curve than most mid-sized and small organizations, but are as advanced, if not more advanced, than larger organizations. Do you see that as well?
Yeah, you know, so I cover the enterprise customers in the Midwestern Chicago. So these are, you know, who would be considering to outsource some of their applications, cloud service providers, and I'm already seeing that happen a lot. You know, first application generally out the door is email, right? So I've seen a lot of customers, you know, the exchange inbox goes out to the cloud, et cetera, because the cost that IT had put together to do it internally was just too high compared to what the cloud service provider was offering. So that is, I've seen a lot of that happen, absolutely, and that is influencing, you know, how the network folks and how the server folks are looking at, you know, what their future plans are in terms of putting together the data center, whether it's the next one they're moving into or how they're re-architecting their existing one. How can we stay competitive to keep these applications in-house and keep, you know, keep ourselves more relevant to the organization, basically?
And this is David Sloan. I'd just like to echo what Dave was saying, is that we've talked to a number of the service providers in quite some depth recently, and I would agree that in all of the areas of what we've called infrastructure 2.0, they are leading the way. They are both from an organizational point of view and from an adoption point of view.
Yeah, so we talked about Trill a little bit. Brad, you mentioned Trill, and I want to go there. But I think we're on an issue here that we're sort of dancing around it, right? The ROI question is still a little bit fuzzy to me, but it's not as fuzzy in that cloud service provider space where they're clearly going after that so-called cloud scale. You don't have to go convince the application owner. They know what's in it for them. It's really driving the business, and maybe that's the tailwind that's going to drive this transition. So that's sort of one possibility. Unless I'm missing something more obvious, it doesn't feel like the average enterprise is choking on today's architecture to the point where they have to move. It feels like the industry is saying, look, guys,
we're trying to get you to skate to the puck so you don't have these problems. But a lot of organizations aren't just going to react to that. What are your thoughts on that, Stu?
Look at what they've done historically, Dave. I mean, especially on the networking side, it's pretty much been an issue of attrition and frankly, oversubscription, right? I mean, look, you can chart this 15, 20 years ago when it was sort of Ethernet versus token rain. But I'm saying, if you look historically, right, I mean, networking and IT operations organizations has specifically been one where it's been a procrastinator's paradise, right? Ethernet token ring, and you know, token ring was far more elegant, although it was, you know, complex to set up and harder to manage. Although when it was shared Ethernet, you know, technology-wise, it was a no-brainer. But you know, why did token ring eventually die? Because you know, when you went to switch to Ethernet, you had a collision domain of one, and from a migration perspective, it was kind of a plug-and-play replacement for shared Ethernet, right? So I didn't actually have to change my end devices at all. And then as we went from 10 meg to 100 meg to 1 gig to 10 gig, you know, there's certainly Cisco is doing things architecturally inside the box to allow better bandwidth and, you know, adding, you know, 802.1 P and Q and these kind of things. But again, from an end user perspective, from an infrastructure ops perspective, you know, you could basically replace a switch and I don't have to do one single thing to my server or my endpoint computing element, right? And so I think when I look at people and they, you know, why did they move from 1 gig to 10 gig when there's a bandwidth constraint and it's generally not on the desktop, it's on the server, and when do people migrate from 1 gig to 10 gig? When it's, you know, when it's cheap enough to do so. So part of the challenge of selling something that is a fundamentally architectural difference that causes an outage is it's got to be a compelling business reason or business value to do it. Otherwise, people are going to just say, you know, I'm just going to wait till 10 gig is cheap enough, and then when the next thing comes along, I'll upgrade my servers for, you know, I'll upgrade my backbone switch, I'll upgrade my server, and it's basically network management by oversubscription. So if you're going to do something different than that, that has been done for the last 25 years, there's got to be a compelling business reason that's going to convince somebody to do something other than just a plug-and-play replacement of existing stuff.
All right, Jerry, so your contention is that it's essentially where we are today, that unless you're doing a new data center or you're a cloud service provider or your business is constrained, people aren't going to move, and those are going to be the catalysts.
That would be my contention. And again, unless somebody in networking can show a absolutely compelling business reason to do it, you know, and it's got to be a significant business reason, right? Like, doing this is going to actually fundamentally change bandwidth revenue streams. Because, frankly, we could do a lot of that with existing quality service and wide area network acceleration platforms with existing technology. 90% of the time, my experience is you go into places, they'll have some of these devices. 90% of the time, you know, they're not using them properly, or they're using them just to 10% of their current capabilities.
Well, so in a lot of cases, it's the business case is simply getting the most of what you've already paid for. So, you know, network infrastructure, you know, tends to life cycle, right? And modules get replaced and line cards get upgraded and things like that just for the, you know, simple hardware life cycle process. So if you've got the right things in place to do it, then you can simply say, well, I've already made the hardware investment, and if I could enable this technology that I've already essentially paid for when I purchased the hardware and I can double the amount of capacity, that makes sense for a lot of ways. And I think so that's what we're seeing too in a lot of existing data centers. And then, you know, of course, there's the whole new data center, which it can be started from scratch.
I don't buy that 100% because, frankly, you know, if somebody was going to get what they paid for, they wouldn't buy Cisco equipment because it's more expensive than everybody else's. So that clearly isn't the only deciding factor. Or Cisco is glad that isn't the only deciding factor.
Well, of course not. I mean, there's the capabilities in the platforms like we've been discussing. You know, VSS, VPC, that's part of the capability Cisco brings and why customers tend to choose those platforms. So it's just, you know, you've already paid for it because you've upgraded the infrastructure, and enabling the technology really doesn't have any incremental cost, but it does have the effect of doubling capacity. So it's pretty, if it's you're in that sort of timeline of your upgrades, then it can make a lot of sense.
The incremental cost is not just capital dollars. There's incremental cost in terms of service outages. There's incremental cost in terms of training people. There's incremental cost in terms of management. Incremental cost isn't always capital investment.
So I want to come back at some point to this and sort of summarize around these drivers, because that's, to me, the real premise of this call, and try to help customers understand, you know, when it makes sense to move. But let's talk about Trill a little bit. Fred, you mentioned Trill. First of all, can you just, for those not familiar with Trill, can you tell us what it is and as a standard and how Cisco is going about implementing it?
Sure. So Trill is called out in RFC 5556, and really, in RFC 5556, that's an IETF draft. It's not really a protocol in the sense that the Trill RFC is more of a problem statement, and then it really describes what characteristics the solution or requirements that any given solution should have to that problem statement. And the problem statement is simply what we've been describing up to this call. You know, the blocking paths, the spanning tree, maybe inefficient forwarding through the network because of blocked paths, etc. So you have Trill out there that says things can change and may need to change, and here's how it should be done. And then so the industry has responded to that, and layer 2 multipathing is an example, and Cisco, you know, Fabric Path, which was announced at Cisco Live this year, is really sort of a pre-standard, you could certainly call it proprietary version of a Trill solution, a layer 2 multipathing solution, where if I've got, you know, a Cisco Nexus 7000 in the distribution of the data center, and I've got Cisco Nexus 7000s or Cisco Nexus NXOS-based platform at the server access layer, certainly have the option of leveraging this Cisco Fabric Path capability. You know, at the same time, the standards process is moving forward. So you have a standard out there, 802.1AQ, shortest path bridging, which really is kind of the standards-based implementation of a Trill solution that is not ratified yet, but is progressing. So, and there's a lot of similarities with that standard that Cisco has in Fabric Path. And Fabric Path does have some enhancements to it that are not in the standard. So maybe those will fold into the standard as well over time. We'll see. But at least the hardware that Cisco is putting out there in the Nexus 7000 and in future hardware platforms will be, at least what I'm told by the engineering folks, is all Trill compliant in terms of, you know, you could convert it over to standards-based Trill implementation if you wish to do so.
Okay. So Brad, on the Trill and Fabric Path piece, I know if you look at FCOE, there's been a lot of discussion about kind of Trill and that kind of functionality, because historically, fiber channel and storage traffic there is no spanning tree. We can just utilize the links, do multipathing. So that's been one of the, quote, limitations when people looked at converging storage onto Ethernet, that you want to be able to leverage that bandwidth. Do you see FCOE as the real driver for Trill? Are there other use cases that you're seeing from customers, irregardless of their storage traffic, that they're using it?
Yeah, there's other use cases. One use case could be high-performance computing. You know, you can build very large, non-blocking 10-gig clusters with thousands of 10-gig ports at basically, you know, no oversubscription or very low oversubscription. And that's all because of the scalability that you can get with a Trill or Fabric Path-based solution, where you can now scale out the data center horizontally at the first tier, at the distribution tier, to add capacity, whereas before you would have to do it in chunks or pairs of switches with spanning tree, blocking links. Internet exchange points, you know, stepping away from the data center for a second, that could be another use case for Trill. Or Fabric Path, where you have, you know, a lot of different service providers now, you know, pairing with 10 gig, and how can you build a, you know, a large fabric that is scalable in its topology, or can be a little bit more arbitrary in the topology and a little bit less structured.
So no. On the scalability, I mean, are we typically talking thousands of ports here versus what you could do before? I mean, I'm just trying to think of, you know, for the customer that's looking at this, if they've only got a few hundred ports, this probably isn't a concern. And, you know, if they're, you know, 5,000, 10,000 ports, this is something they'd want. What are you seeing?
Yeah, so you know, scalability is there. So now we've got this ability to grow the first tier of the. And when I say tier one, I'm talking about the distribution, the kind of the layer two, layer three aggregation point. Typically, that's been in pairs of switches. It's been very structured. So you know, let's say a network with 2,000 10 gig ports, for example, you could certainly do that without Fabric Path or without Trill, but you've got more switches in the environment, you've got more blocking paths, you've got more oversubscription. What you could do with Fabric Path or Trill is basically build that same network with the thousands of 10 gig ports with fewer switches, lower oversubscription, a lot lower cost. Now, for the customer that has a smaller environment and maybe it's just a few hundred gig ports and they've got their two distribution switches there, and they probably may or may not grow beyond that. Yeah, I mean, they could look at Trill. They don't necessarily need to. You know, you've got technologies like VPC or VSS that could be leveraged there. You know, they could certainly look at enabling it, but certainly, you know, they want to stay with their multi-chassis Ether channel. That's certainly something that they could stick with as well.
So let me I haven't really opened it up to the audience. Let me do that right now. I want to come back and talk a little bit about the ROI and some advice for practitioners. So does anybody have any questions or comments? I've unfortunately had to mute a lot of people, so I apologize. I think I've unmuted most, but I'll try to give you guys.
I wanted to add one quick thing to Stu's comment about fiber channel and Trill and Fabric Path.
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of the classic thinking of SAN A, SAN B separation and how you've got basically the server attached to two different completely physically separated SANs, and that's typically viewed as a best practice approach to SAN design today. I think in order for us to leverage FCOE forwarding on a Fabric Path or a Trill network, I think we have to begin to question or at least take another look at the SAN A, SAN B separation in a unified fabric data center infrastructure. That's just something I think we're going to have to, because when you begin to take FCOE and forward it into a Fabric Path network where FCOE frames can go up any length, then you basically have one SAN. At the end of the day, you don't have two separate isolated SANs, and you know, that's really something we have to think about and begin to question. You know, is that legacy isolation something we want to stick with, or something we want to consolidate?
So that's interesting. You're not even. I mean, most people when they talk about converging SAN and LAN networks. You're talking about just converging SAN, separate SANs, which is a common practice.
Right, but in an Ethernet SAN.
Right. So specifically, Brad, what are you recommending there?
Well, you know, I've got my personal opinions on that. I think we certainly can get past the SAN A, SAN B isolation. And I'm not here to say that we should just throw those designs away. I certainly respect the premise of those designs. And I think what we can look at from a Cisco perspective, say, how can we migrate from that? How can we keep SAN A and SAN B separate, even in an FCOE deployment? Because that can be done. But if we want to go beyond that, we want to leverage a more unified fabric where these links leaving the server access layer are carrying FCOE, they're carrying the Ethernet, and it's all maybe on a Fabric Path network, and any packet could go up any link for that additional consolidation. Then, you know, I think the platforms are certainly capable of, in terms of high availability and performance, to begin to look at a consolidated SAN on an Ethernet. And if you look at what customers have been doing with things like IP-based storage, iSCSI and NFS, that, and if you throw that on an Ethernet data center network, that basically is a consolidated, there isn't really SAN A, SAN B separation in like NFS, for example. So we're really just kind of looking, catching up from that perspective with FCOE.
So I would imagine that's going to work for a lot of customers. I would also think it's going to scare some others. Those in particular who are going to say, well, how do you guarantee that I won't lose data? Does anybody have any thoughts on that or comments? Or are people comfortable with that whole SAN A, SAN B consolidation?
I would say, Dave, for the customer that is scared of it, that's okay. I'm not going to be the person who comes in and says, no, you should throw that out and do it this way.
Right.
You know, if you want to maintain your SAN A, SAN B separation in a multi-hop FCOE network, you can certainly do that through what we call unified dedicated wires, where let's say you've got two top of rack switches that are FCOE switches, and switch number one would have a dedicated link that would only go up to, one SAN A, for example, and then switch number two in that top of rack would have a dedicated link that only goes to SAN B, for example. That would be carrying FCOE frames. So they're still, preserving some of that SAN A, SAN B isolation, even with FCOE. And then all of the normal Ethernet uplinks out of those top of rack switches are just carrying, the normal data. So it can be done today. That's how customers are doing it. But if a customer is not scared of it, or if they feel comfortable with the platforms and some success cases out there, there's certainly the opportunity to have more of a consolidated, unified fabric.
So Brad, we got a note over on Twitter asking how does 100 gig fit into this whole equation?
Yeah, 100 gig. So I would even take a step back and say 40 gig. So 40 gig is, we'll start to see some of that in the server access layer, probably next year, be it in blade chassis, be it in server interfaces. And then when we start to progress with more 40 gig deployments in the server access layer, then 100 gig at the distribution and the core layer begins to make sense, more sense as an interconnect. And that's where the dense platforms, that have a lot of bandwidth capabilities per slot would make it pretty easy to just deploy some 100 gig interconnects between your core switches in the data center. I don't really see 100 gig coming in the server access layer, in the next couple of years, but I could be wrong.
Right, I think that's why we've got the dual solution of 40 and 100, 40, right, as you said, for the server access and 100 for the core. And I have to think that when you start looking at least for the next, 5 years or so, what the cost of a 40 or 100 gig port are going to be, spanning tree can't be in the mix, just because of what the cost of that infrastructure is going to be.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
Up blocking or oversubscription. So I guess what I'm saying is if we look at over the next, 3 years, as some of these new bandwidths start coming out, this is kind of the opportunity that customers have to start, enhancing or replacing spanning tree with VSS, VPC, Trill, because by the time they've moved to those next generation architecture, those next generation bandwidth, they need to have implemented the architectural changes.
Yep, that makes a lot of sense. And also, so VPC, VSS, Trill at the, from the server access layer up to the core of the network. Then there's also some changes that we didn't touch on too much on this call in the actual server access layer down to the server that really begin to reduce the spanning tree footprint out of that environment. Things like fabric extenders, for example, where I can basically have what is not a switch at the top of the rack, but it's really a remote line card. And the IEEE standard that translates to that is 802.1BH, bridge port extension. And the Cisco is already shipping that in a form now using VN tags. So there's that, so fabric extenders, and there's also mode of operations in some of these top-of-rack switches that could reduce the spanning tree footprint as well. One example of that is end host mode in Cisco UCS, where the fabric interconnect links up to the data center network, not as a switch running spanning tree, but it's like a server, like an end host. And so you can begin to reduce the spanning tree footprints at the server access layer in that regard too. And instead of using spanning tree to pick up links for forward traffic, you basically pin server traffic to a specific uplink. Another example of that would be like, HP Virtual Connect, right? There's a lot of cross-vendor movement of getting to server access layer technologies that do more of an intelligent uplink to the network.
good. Okay, last chance. Anybody have any comments, questions for Brad, Stu? Want to weigh in? Because I want to go back to this issue of ROI for a second. But I'll give people a second if they want to comment. Okay. All right. David Flory, you on the line?
Yes, I am. I got dumped a couple of times.
So I want to look at this question of ROI. Just what I'm hearing, my notes on cost. We've got potentially new cards, some software, maybe some new switching infrastructure. Jerry mentioned some training costs and obviously some disruption. So that's sort of my cost side of the equation. And on the benefit side, I mean, it's essentially one half the port cost, right? We're talking about 1 gig between, you said $5,000 to $8,000 for 48 ports, so it's, you know, whatever, $100, $150 somewhere in there per port versus $250 for 10 gig ports. So let's say half the port cost as the hard dollar. And then beyond that, there's some soft dollar benefits, the flexibility, the ability to grow, you know, less business constraints, which are going to appeal, obviously, to new data center people, the cloud service providers, and those that are growth constrained. Am I missing any hard dollar costs?
I would put a couple of additional softer dollar benefits there. The first is that you have to be growing the network in line with the total amount of data that's going to be flying around it. As the data grow, the volumes grow, so the network requirement grows to move that data. Larger pipes are in general more efficient, so you can use those more efficiently than you can lots of smaller pipes. And the second thing is that from a performance point of view, from a business point of view, if you the elapsed time for to be moving stuff from A to B will be significantly lower with larger pipes. And that in many recovery situations, in many RPO, RTO situations, will be a critical component. So that's another soft stroke hard area which will drive migration at some point.
Okay, so you had two. More efficient utilization and lower migration costs, which are, I'm not sure the first one is soft dollars, right? That's going to actually translate.
I think it's actually a hard one, yes.
And that's really port cost, is it not? And that's
ultimately line costs, yes. Port cost, line cost.
Yeah, okay. So port cost and line cost. And then the other piece, you know, depends. Some people would consider lower migration costs hard dollars as well. But okay,
there is another hard cost.
Go ahead.
There is another hard cost. There hasn't been any discussion about the cabling differences and requirements.
Right, that's just, yeah, agreed.
Well, can you just give us your first name or first and last?
My name's Michael Benjamin.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Do you want to elaborate a little bit on that? Or?
Well, of course, just with gigabit Ethernet, you can be as low as, Cat5e cabling and to go to 10 gigabit and be positioned for 40 and beyond. The cabling requirements are going to be much more stringent, and they're going to add significant costs when you get into port densities.
Great. Okay. So I think when I go back to the premise here, current network topologies are inadequate to meet the flexibility and scaling demands of burgeoning virtualized data centers and cloud environments. Having said that, it sounds like the community feels like new data centers, cloud service providers, and those customers that are growth constrained are going to be the ones that really are going to get a return on new network architectures that are emerging. We talked about a number of them, VSS, VPC. We talked about where Trill fits. And the cost of this migration, the cost-benefit analysis is new cards, software, new switching infrastructure, potentially training, the cost of disruption and cabling cost, and the benefits are port cost reduction to about one half. Line costs, I don't know, David, if you can posit a guess as to what the improvement there would be. and then lower migration cost as well as greater network flexibility and growth. So the math is going to seem pretty straightforward on this in terms of when it makes sense for customers to migrate. Is there, in the last 3 or 4 minutes here, are there any other closing thoughts, Brad or Stu, in terms of advice for customers that you would give, or anybody else?
Well, I'd say in terms of the migration, you know, you could think of it as a cost of, okay, how do I change the network architecture to do things like VSS, VPC, Trill? But at the same time, you have to look at, you know, what is changing in the server environment with the migration to 10 gig, as was brought up. So you might be, you know, going through and having to look at changing the network architecture because of that migration to 10 gig in the server and, you know, the hardware investments that are made there. And then in those hardware investments, you know, you may have already, you know, made that investment to make that change to a different, you know, architecture above and beyond spanning tree, right? So you might have kind of some projects running in parallel there, or at least the transition to 10 gig really being the genesis of that.
I'd like to go back to what you were talking about earlier, which is my belief that a very, very important trend here will be the requirement to be cost effective against service providers. And if installations are not addressing these cost issues, fundamental cost issues, as they try and migrate to what we've called infrastructure 2.0, they will find themselves not competitive internally within their organizations. So this is going to be one of many important areas where they have to be cost competitive and will have to make sure they can sell the disruptions required to get there.
Okay, excellent. That's a good point, David, that you know, this is sort of an insidious trend because the cost-benefit analysis says that for a lot of customers there's not a real incentive to move. However, you've got this sort of cloud hanging over your head, so to speak. And if you don't address the cost factors, you might end up behind the curve, probably already are behind the curve. But that's going to be a tough sell to a lot of organizations. So I think Brad's point about run stuff in parallel, start small, bring it in, do the pilots, get experience with it so you can accelerate, learn, accelerate some of those other hidden costs down the road, the disruption, the training, and the like, is probably the way to go.
Agreed.
Okay. Great. Any last words? Stu, Brad? Okay, good. I think we covered it pretty well. So, Brad, thank you very much for coming on the call today. Really appreciate your insights.
Thank you for the invite. I appreciate that.
And, Stu, thank you as well for setting this up, making it happen, tweeting it out. Appreciate it. On behalf of the Wikibon community, I'd like to thank those other members who contributed in the call today. Jerry Murphy, always you. Big points. David Floyer, thank you. And Michael Benjamin for the comments there on the other cabling costs. Thanks for that. As a reminder, our next Peer Insight is scheduled for next week, 12 noon Eastern Time, which is Tuesday, August 3rd, and the topic is cloud security. And joining us is Lincoln Cannon, who's the Director of Web Systems at Merit Medical. And as another reminder, over the next 24 hours or so, we're going to have up on Wikibon 6 research notes pertaining to the call today with user actions. So look for that, and feel free to hit the edit tab and improve the pieces or put up your own piece or even write a wiki tip. And we'll be producing a podcast of this call that we'll be sending out as well. So thanks for listening today, everybody, and thanks for being a Wikibon member. Bye for now.